Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Big E here. This is episode 104 of Law for Virginia Law Enforcement Officers. And we're talking about Miranda and invocations of the right to remain silent and lawful Miranda waivers in the context of two really significant cases, I think, from the Court of Appeals last week, all on the same day. We actually had three cases on Miranda all in one day from the Court of Appeals, and we don't really get a lot of Fifth Amendment cases from the Virginia Court of Appeals, so it's unusual to get one, it's definitely unusual to get two, and to get three, I don't know of a time when we've had three cases in one day on the issue, so definitely worth talking about. And these cases, the court reversed a conviction in a murder case from the city of Richmond. They reversed a conviction in a child rape case from Fairfax County, but they ended up affirming the conviction for another murder case. It was a no-body homicide case from the city of Virginia Beach. So I want to dive into these facts because while these are very significant crimes, the cases and the facts and what the court ruled has implications for really any case where you're out there reading people Miranda and seeking a Miranda waiver. So let's dive into these cases and talk about them. I want to talk first about the case from Fairfax County. And the case from Fairfax County, the facts are horrible. So I don't want to spend too much time on them. But it's important to understand a little bit about the facts because they help to drive what ultimately results in the court reversing the conviction and finding that the Miranda waiver is not valid. So what happens in this case is the defendant in this case, Thomas, works at a daycare center, and he sexually assaults a child, actually multiple children. He sexually assaults a child, and he is convicted of sexually assaulting a child. And he serves his time, gets out, is placed on probation, and for about 5 years, he's supervised by a probation officer. And he signs probation conditions that say he has to follow all the probation officer's instructions, and the probation officer explains to him the consequences, you know, if you don't follow the probation officer's instructions, you know, bad things will happen to you, et cetera, et cetera. And that ends up being pretty important in this case because police come to learn that while he'd been working at this daycare center, he had raped and sexually assaulted a child between the ages of 4 and 8 years old, multiple occasions between when the child was 4 and when the child was 8. And so the child, many years later, about 10 years later, discloses the sexual assaults. And police go back and investigate. They ultimately arrest the defendant, and they bring him in. And at the time, he's on probation. So they ask for the probation officer's help. They bring the defendant to the police department. They sit him down in an interrogation room. And then the probation officer brings in the two detectives, and the probation officer introduces the detectives. Now, this conversation ends up being crucial and ends up ultimately being what results in the conviction being reversed. So here's what the probation officer says to the defendant. The probation officer says, this is detective, and he gives the detective's names. This is detective, you know, Jones and Smith. And he says, they need to talk to you about some things. I'm going to be here for a little bit, but just go ahead and chat with them today, okay? And then the probation officer leaves the room. At that point, then, the officers review the defendant's Miranda rights with him. And the officer's words here are important, too. The officers talk about how, oh, you know, the government loves his forms. I know you're going to have questions about everything, and I'm happy to talk about this stuff to you, but we got to go over this form first. And it's just, you know, it's just a formality. We just got to do this form. So he goes through the form, and the defendant ultimately waives his Miranda rights. And ultimately, in the interview, confesses to this horrible attack on this child. So the case goes to court, and the defendant is convicted. And the Court of Appeals reverses the conviction. Now, You may ask, how in the world does it get reversed? They read him Miranda, and the defendant says he understands his Miranda rights, and he waives his Miranda rights, and the court reverses the conviction. What happened? Well, the court here rules that based on the totality of the circumstances, the defendant's Miranda waiver was not the product of a free and unconstrained choice. And here that the government used coercive tactics to get the defendant to talk to the police. Well, what did the government do? What was coercive? The court here says that the defendant's probation obligation includes following all of his probation officer's instructions. In fact, they look at the conditions, and one of them is to be truthful with the probation officer. He'd signed the form saying his understanding was that failing to comply with probation could result in his probation being revoked. And so when the probation officer comes in and says, hey, I'm going to be here for a little bit, but go ahead and talk with and chat with them today, okay? The court says that that's basically an order from the probation officer to talk to the police, and a defendant would reasonably understand that if he didn't follow that order, that his probation would be revoked. And so the court said here the defendant would reasonably believe he couldn't simultaneously comply with his probation officer's instruction to talk specifically to talk to the detectives and also invoke his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. So to start out with, you may say, okay, well, does that mean I can never interview anybody who's on probation? And the court says no. And there's a lot of law about this, but the law is very clear. You can talk to somebody who's on probation, and you don't have to read the Miranda even, because if as long as they're not in custody. And the court says what makes this case different than normal cases when you talk to someone who's on probation is that in this case, the defendant is in custody. Okay, that's the first difference. But you still may ask yourself, okay, but a lot of people I talk to in custody are also on probation. And the court here says, well, again, what's important is the probation officer's specific instruction to the defendant, go ahead and talk to these officers. The court rejects the argument that that somehow anybody who's on probation, who's in custody, is facing, you know, potentially a penalty for not being truthful, that somehow that they can't waive Miranda. And that's important, right? Because we know, you know, the court is distinguishing this case from what's called a classic penalty situation. And one of those situations that might be familiar to you is Garrity, a case called Garrity, right? And in Garrity, there, that was a case where police officers were being investigated for a series of crimes that they were committing. It was up in New York, New Jersey, involving the Port Authority and so on. And they were, you know, they understood that they had to talk to investigators, that if they invoked their right to remain silent or invoked the right to an attorney, that they'd be fired. And so the court there in that case said, well, in that case, you're clearly not voluntarily talking to the government because the government has told you, if you don't talk to us, you're going to suffer an economic consequence. You're going to be fired. And so that's why in Garrity, you have these special rules about talking to government employees who are facing potentially being fired. It's also why, for example, you got to be really careful about saying to somebody something like, hey, if you don't tell me what happened to your kid who got hurt, CPS is going to come take your kid away. Right. Well, that person isn't being threatened with incarceration. That person's being threatened with something worse, losing their children. And so you can overcome somebody's will unlawfully. You can coerce somebody into talking without ever laying your hands on them or threatening them with jail if you say something like, if you don't talk to me, I'm taking your kids away. Right. And so that can violate the Fifth Amendment. Here in this case, the court said this was an inherently coercive custodial interrogation technique. And because of that, any Miranda waiver is not voluntary, right? Just like in Garrity, or if I threaten to take your kids away or whatever. So what could the officers have done here? The court here says, well, in this case, the officers don't provide any assurance to the defendant that there's no penalty for him if he disregards the probation officer's specific instruction to chat with the officers. And so just reading Miranda doesn't overcome what the probation officer had just said, which was an instruction to speak to the detectives. And the detectives and the police officers didn't clarify that he wouldn't suffer any adverse probationary consequences if he, for example, decided to exercise his right to remain silent or exercise his right to an attorney. And so the court here says the defendant reasonably understood he had to talk to the police. And this is important to understand about Miranda, that you can obtain a confession in full compliance with Miranda, but if you obtain it in a way that's not voluntary, that is, if you force or coerce that person into talking, the Miranda warnings don't fix the problem, right? Here, in this case, the court criticized the officers for treating Miranda as a formality, saying things like, oh, the government, look how the government likes his forms. I'll explain everything to you, but we got to get through these forms first. It's just a formality, but we got to do it first. And so the court criticizes the officers for not helping him understand that he could say no. And in this case, it was interesting. Usually someone's previous experience with the criminal justice system will weigh in favor of their Miranda waiver. But here the court said it weighed against it. And the court right here, Thomas is a man of limited intellectual functioning who for years had obeyed his probation officer's instructions because he knew that failure to do so could result in the loss of the grace of the prior sentencing court had extended him by suspending part of his sentence. The detective subjected Thomas to an inherently coercive custodial interrogation, exacerbated by the tacit pressure of a possible probation revocation. The detective's subsequent reading of Miranda warnings, presented to Thomas as a mere formality, failed to cure the coercive circumstances presented here, which overbore his will to make a free and unconstrained choice. And so in this case, the court found his Miranda waiver was involuntary and his incriminating statements were inadmissible. Now the question is, okay, well, what about in the future? Well, the court says we're not making a rule. Okay, we're not saying in the future there's any particular kind of rule here. Judge Raphael, who dissents from this ruling, is very concerned about this, though. He really finds this to be troubling. The court here, Judge Raphael says, it's difficult to see how, in the majority's logic, law enforcement officers could ever involve a probation officer in a custodial interrogation without being required to give special warnings prior to or going beyond Miranda. And Judge Raphael says, although the majority denies imposing such a per se requirement, its opinion repeatedly implies that the probation officer or the detectives here had to tell Thomas he could invoke his Fifth Amendment privilege without jeopardizing his probation. And so he criticizes this ruling and says the majority commits a grave error by tacking a codicil, an addendum, onto standard Miranda warnings for cases involving probationers who were in custody. And this new exception to the invocation requirement really, for him, finds no support in the case law of our or any other jurisdiction. So he's really troubled by this. For the future, you really want to be careful if you were interviewing somebody who is in custody and the probation officer is involved in any way, because you can end up exactly the same way. So there's two more cases I want to talk about. One of them is from the city of Richmond, where the court reverses a conviction, and one is from Virginia Beach, where the court affirms. And both of them involve an actual invocation or attempt to invoke the potential invocation of the right to remain silent. And as a reminder, remember here, one can invoke the right to an attorney, and one can also invoke the right to remain silent. And if somebody clearly and unambiguously invokes their right to remain silent, just like if they invoke the right to an attorney, all questioning has to cease. You have to stop talking to them. And I find, a lot of officers are surprised by that because it rarely ever happens. Most Americans know that if I want an interrogation to stop, I just say, attorney, I want a lawyer, and it's over. Well, you can do the same thing by saying, I want to remain silent. And when you say, I want to remain silent, the questioning has to cease. And unfortunately, in the Paxton case, that's not what happened. In the Paxton case, this is a case from the city of Richmond where the defendant killed his girlfriend. And police investigated the case, identified him as the perpetrator, and brought him in and talked to him. While they're talking to him, they ask him, he says, sir, I did not shoot her. And the officer, you did shoot her. Defendant, I don't want to talk no more. Officer, okay, that's fair enough, absolutely fair enough. I gave you the opportunity to talk, you didn't want to talk, and that's fine. So you're being charged now with the carjacking of the car and the use of the firearm in the commission of a felony, and you'll be taken to the magistrate and processed. Defendant, sir, officer, yes. Defendant, what? Officer, unless you can come up with a reasonable explanation. Defendant, Sir, what else do you want to know? I'm telling you everything. Officer, I want to hear the truth. And at that point, they continue to have a conversation, and after about 20 minutes, he confesses to having killed his girlfriend. And the defendant moves to suppress. So the question in this case is kind of twofold. The first is, when he says, I don't want to talk no more, did the officer respect that decision to invoke his right to remain silent? And then after that, did the defendant reinitiate when he said, sir, what? So the court here emphasizes, and again, this is important. When you make the statement, I don't want to answer any more questions, that is an unambiguous invocation of the right to remain silent. And that goes back many decades, right? There's a case, that phrase comes from a case called Akers versus Commonwealth, which was from 1975. Here the court says the defendant's statement, I don't want to talk no more, is equally an unambiguous invocation of his right to remain silent. And once he's made that unambiguous invocation of the right to remain silent, all questioning has to cease. You can continue talking to him, right? It's not a matter of not talking to him. You can say, you know, do you want some water? You can explain what's going to happen. And here the officer does that. The officer says, all right, you're being charged with the carjacking of the car, use of a firearm, you're going to be taken to the magistrate and processed. All that's okay. But the interrogation, the interview, the questioning, using statements that are likely to elicit an incriminating response, that has to end. And the court here addresses, well, when he says, sir, and then the officer responds, yes, and he says, what, is that a reinitiation of his of the interrogation, of the conversation, such that he's now waiving his right to remain silent? And the court here says, well, not really, and if the officer is going to scrupulously respect his right to remain silent, let's look at what the officer says in a response. And the officer's response is, unless you can come up with a reasonable explanation, and that's when he says, well, what do you want to know? I'm telling you everything. And then the conversation begins, you know, and he ultimately confesses to having murdered his girlfriend. And here the court says, by dangling the possibility of escaping criminal liability if he keeps talking, that's not him respecting or trying to respect his invocation of right to remain silent. That's trying to overcome the defendant's decision to end the conversation, to invoke his right to remain silent. And the court says, if an officer is unsure about whether a suspect wishes to reinitiate the interrogation, he properly may question the suspect about whether he wishes to remain silent. Right? So, you know, for example, you can say, we'll give a good example of that in a second. In Rashad, officers said, hey, we can't talk to you anymore because you asked for a lawyer. That's where a guy asked for an attorney. The defendant said in the Medley case, I want all my rights, but I still want to talk to you. And there the court said, well, you know, the officers, when they responded, said, hey, look, we can't talk to you unless you waive your rights, right? That's respecting his rights in that circumstance. But here, instead of inquiring, do you want to talk to me? Do you not want to talk to me? Instead of reiterating his rights, attempting to answer his question or asking him to clarify his question, he simply says, hey, look, you know, unless you have a better explanation. And at that point, the court says that's not a scrupulous respect for his invocation of the right to remain silent. And so the court suppresses the evidence. And I think that's a really interesting contrast with a ruling the same day in Johnson versus Commonwealth, which is a case from Virginia Beach. And in Johnson versus Commonwealth, Johnson is a case where it's a no-body homicide case. The defendant abducts and kills the mother of his children. And he disposes of her body in such a way that to this day we've never found, law enforcement has never found her body. She disappears suddenly out of nowhere, doesn't go to work, misses her son's baseball games, we've never seen her again. They find her vehicle nearby, abandoned. They search the defendant's phone and they figure out he searched the internet for Suffolk garbage dump, Suffolk waste disposal, where does dumpster trash go, Virginia, and where does dumpster trash go, Chesapeake. And on that day, his cell phone records show that his phone went to where the vehicle, victim's vehicle, was abandoned, and her keys were thrown in the trash. And, you know, anyway, so there you go. All right, so officers end up arresting him, bring him in, they read him Miranda, and they talk to him for 19 hours. Now, they don't talk to him straight through for 19 hours. Each conversation only lasts about 30 minutes, and they give him lots of breaks for food and snacks and so on. So, you know, they're talking in these little 30-minute increments. But, you know, they're talking to him over the course of 19 hours. And about halfway into the interview, they bring him out around 11 a.m., and he's talking about 5 or 6 p.m. They're asking him lots of questions about him leaving his twin children alone in the apartment, which he does when he goes and disposes of his body. Leaves the children alone a lot. The defendant says, they're asking questions about, you know, we want to talk to you about the kids being alone and what's going on and why you're leaving the kids alone and yada, yada. And he says, look, I don't have anything else to say, man. If you want to take me to jail, I don't have anything else to say, man. And in response, the officer says, well, this is your opportunity. This is your chance. You don't have to say anything. You know, we went through your rights and you have your rights. I'm just concerned about you making a really poor decision. You want to make the right decisions for your children. And at that point, the interview continues. And so here again, we have exactly the same issue that we had in the Richmond case, right? Which is, did he invoke his right to remain silent? And if so, did the officers respect his right to remain silent? Now, I'll start out by saying, you know, a 19-hour long interview, that might seem to you to be inherently coercive. But here the court says, well, it's over the course of 19 hours. But again, each interview is only about a half hour long. They don't talk to me in half hour increments. They give him lots of breaks. They ask him if he's okay. They ask him if he wants food, you know, go to the bathroom, bring snacks, blah, blah, blah. And they are not screaming at him and yelling at him. The conversation is entirely conversational. They're not threatening him or anything like that. A couple of times, one of the detectives raises her voice, but that's basically it, right? They're basically having just a conversation. So the court says, that doesn't make the interview unlawful. And they look at the police techniques. They say that doesn't make the, you know, doesn't, they weren't overly coercive, that kind of thing. It wasn't overly coercive. But the part of this ruling that I really want to focus on here is this statement, I don't have anything else to say, man. If y'all want to take me to jail, I don't have anything else to say. And here the defendant says, that's a clear and unambiguous invocation of the right to remain silent. Now, it's interesting because there are two cases that are very similar to this. There's the case which is Adkins versus the Commonwealth, which is a case from just a couple of years ago from the Virginia Supreme Court. And in that case, when the officer reads him Miranda, do you have your right to remain silent, do you have a right to an attorney, etc., his response is, I don't have no more to say to you. And at that point, the officers leave the room. And in that case, the court said, that's a clear and unambiguous invocation of the right to remain silent. In other words, they read him his rights. You know, here are your rights. Are you willing to talk to me? Response, I don't have no more to say to you. The court says, that's a clear and unambiguous invocation of the right to remain silent. He's saying, when they say, do you want to talk to us? His response is, I don't have nothing to say. So there, because it happens right after the interrogation begins, right, that's an invocation of the right to remain silent. But Adkins has to deal with the fact that the Virginia Supreme Court had ruled in a case called Green versus Commonwealth a couple of decades ago, where they're talking to a guy named Green about a murder, and they're talking to him for a very long time, several hours, and they say, hey, look, this is the evidence. You know, it looks like it wasn't self-defense. And he says, it was self-defense. I swear it was. You know, that's what I'm telling you. It's self-defense. He attacked me. I killed him. Well, Green, the evidence doesn't seem to, you know, doesn't match what you're saying. And he says, I don't know what to tell you. I don't got nothing more to say. That's what happened, right? So kind of like Forrest Gump, he's saying, like, that's, I got nothing more to add to that. The court says that's not an unambiguous invocation of the right to remain silent. And so in Adkins, the court says, you have to look at the context. And in context, in Green, it was clear that he was saying to the police, I don't have any more fact, nothing more to tell you about the story than what I've already told you. I've told you all of the facts as I know them. There are no more facts to add. I don't have any more information to share after this long interrogation. Whereas in Adkins, him saying, I don't got nothing more to say, I don't have no more to say to you, is in response to the question, are you willing to talk to us? And so context is really important. And here in the case from Virginia Beach in Johnson, the court says, again, context is crucial. The context here is 5 hours of non-coercive conversation where he's willing to talk to the police. And in the context of this conversation, he says, I don't have anything else to say. Here, the court says, and he says it after several questions about his children's whereabouts. So here the court says the officers reasonably could have thought he's saying, I just have nothing more to say in regard to the questioning about the children. And so what I want you to notice, though, about this is the response of the officers is what the court finds so compelling. The officers, in response to the statement, say, they remind him that he has the right to remain silent, right? And he says, they say, you don't have to say anything, right? They remind him of the right to remain silent. They don't, you know, say it in exactly those words, but they say, literally, you don't have to say anything. And then they say, we went through your rights and you have your rights. So they remind him of his rights. And then after that, he says, he doesn't say, okay, yeah, and I don't have anything else to say to you, right? He doesn't say, I'm invoking my rights. He doesn't say, I don't got nothing more to say. After they remind him of his rights, he continues to answer questions for the next 10 hours. And so that single statement in context, I don't have anything else to say, here the court says that's not something that a reasonable police officer would understand to be an invocation of the right to remain silent. And that, I think, is really interesting. If you look at other statements in other cases, in Mitchell versus Commonwealth, somebody saying, I don't have anything else to say, man, in response to, you know, a whole long series of questions, that may not be an invocation of the right to remain silent, right? Mitchell was somebody who was having a long conversation with the police and then says, I ain't got shit to say to y'all, right? That wasn't sufficiently unambiguous in context. Green, again, was, I don't have anything else anymore to say after a whole long conversation. So the court found in those cases, right, that in context wasn't a clear and unambiguous invocation of the right to remain silent. So, you know, what do you do? How do you handle this? What are you supposed to do as a law enforcement officer in these situations where people say something ambiguous? Number one is you got to be attuned to what somebody's saying. You got to listen to the statements, right? And there are cases from the Court of Appeals and the Virginia Supreme Court where convictions are reversed because an officer did not hear somebody say, I want a lawyer. And that's terrible, right? You never want to do that. And to avoid that, the number one thing you can do is don't talk to somebody by yourself. Just if you're sitting there questioning somebody, have someone else there. Because if you're asking questions, that likely means you're not listening. You're either talking or you're listening, and you can't do both. It's just not humanly possible to do both effectively. So if one person's asking questions, the other person should be sitting there listening. And you got to listen for, I want a lawyer, or I want to remain silent. And I want to remain silent may not sound exactly like the phrase, I want to remain silent. It might be, I don't got nothing more to say, right? Or I got nothing, you know, I'm done talking, that kind of thing. I'm choosing not to talk anymore. I'm choosing not to talk anymore is an invocation of the right to remain silent, and you need to be attuned to that. And the second is, if it is not clear whether or not the person has invoked the right to remain silent, then the two things that you can do that are really going to help you is, number one, is remind that person of their rights, right? Remind them they have the right to remain silent. Remind them of the right to an attorney. Remind them they don't have to talk to you. And then clarify, are you telling us that you don't want to talk to us anymore? Are you saying that this conversation is over? Or are you just saying, well, you know, I don't have any more facts to add, right? And you don't have to use those exact words. But you want to remind the person of their rights, and then you want to clarify their intentions. What are they saying when they say, I don't got nothing else to say? You know, at the end of the day, if the person's willing to talk to you, they're willing to talk to you. If they're not willing to talk to you, they're not willing to talk to you. And, you know, not magically trying to ignore the fact that they're trying to invoke is only going to hurt you, right? So tough week, I think, for the Commonwealth, you know, when you lose a murder case, and a murder conviction, and a child rape conviction. That's terrible. But hopefully these three cases today have some lessons that you can take into the future and use effectively. I hope you found today useful. We will keep talking about these issues and more in future episodes. If you like the podcast, tell your friends. We're on SoundCloud. We're on Apple Podcasts. We'll get onto other podcast apps as I can throughout the year. If you don't like the podcast, don't tell your friends. But for today, that's all from me. That's all from Big E. Stay safe and don't get captured.